From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The Tulsa Race Riot of 1921 is considered by many historians to be the bloodiest race riot in American history. African Americans were shot, burned alive, and tied to cars and dragged through the streets by a white mob. About 1,000 homes were burned down. The Oklahoma State Legislature appointed a panel to investigate what really happened and recommend whether reparations should be given to survivors. On today's Fresh Air, we'll hear from the author of the new report which recommends reparations and could set an important precedent. And we'll hear from a survivor of the riot whose house was burned down. He was 8 years old at the time. The Tulsa Race Riot of 1921, coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Texas Governor George W. Bush aimed to solidify his front-runner status, and Arizona Senator John McCain tried to regain momentum as voters went to the polls today in Michigan and Arizona. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Pledging to take on the party establishment, Senator McCain came home to Arizona last night and told a crowd of several thousand in Tucson the race was down to two. Clearly pleased to be on his home turf, McCain told supporters every day is do or die in his race. Results from today's voting in Michigan will be pivotal for McCain, the last contest before a succession of 16 primaries and caucuses over the next 2 weeks. While McCain headed home to Arizona, which he expects to win handily today, Bush stayed in Michigan through the morning, encouraging party stalwarts to get to the polls. Early exit polls indicate Bush is winning conservatives, those who say moral issues are a top priority, while McCain is faring well with baby boomers and union members, people who say they like him because he stands up for his beliefs. Elizabeth Arnold, NPR News. Phoenix.
The space shuttle Endeavour has landed safely at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida. Commander Kevin Kriegel piloted the shuttle in just after sunset after being delayed for one orbit by gusty winds on the ground. The six astronauts aboard Endeavour completed 11 days of surveying the Earth's surface with radar. The result is expected to be the most precise topographical map ever produced. NASA and its partner in the project, the National Imagery and Mapping Agency, say it could take up to 2 years to analyze all the information. German prosecutors raided regional offices of the political party of former Chancellor Helmut Kohl in his home state today. The prosecutor sought information related to the huge funding scandal involving Kohl. NPR's Edward Lifson reports from Berlin.
Several investigators entered the Christian Democratic Union's regional party headquarters in Mainz, the capital of Rhineland-Palatinate state. Party officials there said the prosecutors took away a number of documents. A spokesman for the Bonn State Prosecutor's Office said the search was part of the investigation of Helmut Kohl, but declined to comment on what was seized. Kohl has admitted accepting $1 million in illegal campaign contributions while chancellor. He faces parliamentary and criminal investigations. Officials from Kohl's Christian Democratic Party said the search in Mainz followed an anonymous tip that Kohl had ordered documents transferred there from the federal chancellery. Prosecutors abandoned plans yesterday to search Kohl's house and office. They said the element of surprise was lost when a news magazine leaked word of the raid before it happened. Edward Lifson, NPR News, Berlin.
Stock prices came to a mixed close today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 85 points to close at 10,304. Declining issues edged advances in heavy trading of 975 million shares. The Nasdaq lost 30 points to close at 43,081. This is NPR. Defense attorneys made their closing arguments today in the trial of four white New York City police officers accused of murdering a West African immigrant. The attorneys warned their clients had no choice but to open fire on Amadou Diallo because he refused to stop for questioning and drew what they believed was a gun. Prosecutors said the policemen are guilty of second-degree murder and reckless endangerment. They said the plainclothes officers cornered the 22-year-old man in the vestibule of his apartment building, then opened fire without warning. Testimony has resumed in the wrongful imprisonment trial of Dr. Sam Shepard. Lee Garnett of member station WCPN reports from Cleveland.
Sam Reese Shepard, the son of the physician who's pressing this case, testified he had an idyllic childhood until his mother was murdered in 1954. His late father was convicted of the crime, but was acquitted in a retrial after spending 10 years in an Ohio prison. Now his son hopes to win damages from the state. Shepard told the jury there was no tension between his parents the day before the murder. He said he knows his father was innocent. State attorneys questioned Shepard extensively about his book deals and movie contracts related to the celebrated case, and during cross-examination, Shepard admitted his father told him he had an open marriage. This could buttress the state's contention that Shepard killed his wife because he felt trapped in the relationship. For NPR News, I'm Lee Garnett in Cleveland.
The U.S. Supreme Court has agreed to consider whether it's constitutional for police to set up traffic checkpoints and conduct random searches of cars for illegal drugs. The justices will review a case from Indiana in which two residents challenged a police program that involved random traffic stops in Indianapolis. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing soy and a variety of soy products to consumers around the world. ADM Supermarket to the world. On the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On a spring day in 1921, the African-American section of Tulsa, Oklahoma, was burned down by a white mob. The riot was set off after a black man was accused of attacking a white woman and was threatened with the possibility of lynching. In this neighborhood of about 8,000 people, more than 1,000 homes were burned to the ground, thousands of people were left homeless, and an estimated 100 to 300 people were killed. The Oklahoma legislature recently appointed a commission to investigate what happened during the riot and whether any reparations should be given. In a few minutes, we'll hear from a survivor of the riot whose house was burned down. First, we'll hear from Alfred Brophy. He wrote the Tulsa Race Riot Commission's report, which recommends reparations for survivors and could set an important precedent for other states. The report was presented to the legislature earlier this month. Brophy is a professor of law at Oklahoma City University. I asked him to describe the scope of the destruction after the riot.
The destruction was extraordinary. More than 30 blocks of Greenwood, the black section of Tulsa, were burned to the ground. Some of the photographs that you see of the riot scene are reminiscent of Carthage or Hiroshima after World War II. Very little left standing. You'll see occasionally scenes of concrete or piles of brick, telephone poles, metal bedstands, and very little else.
What set off the riot?
The riot was set off on the evening of May 31st, 1921, when a group of black World War I veterans showed up at the Tulsa County Courthouse to try and stop what they thought was going to be the lynching of 19-year-old Dick Rowland. He was a young black man who worked shining shoes in an office building downtown Tulsa, and he'd gone up to the top of a nearby building to use the segregated bathroom facilities there. As he was exiting the elevator, the story, so far as we can now reconstruct it, is that he tripped and fell into 17-year-old Mary Page, who was a white woman who worked as the elevator operator. And at the time, she screamed, he ran out of the elevator, and nobody thought anything else of it. The Tulsa Tribune, one of the two leading white newspapers in town, picked this story up in its afternoon edition on May 31st and ran two stories, so far as we can tell. One of them talking about the attempted assault on Mary Page, and the other one an editorial which has since been lost, which we think was encouraging folks to go and lynch Dick Rowland. The editorial's been lost, actually, so we don't know exactly what it said. Folks then down in Greenwood, the black section of town, started to get worried that Dick Rowland was going to be lynched. And there's some interesting stories about sort of what's going on in black and white Tulsa. The newspaper hits the streets about 4 p.m., and people down in Greenwood get very agitated, very concerned that Rowland is going to be lynched. By about 7 o'clock in the evening, a contingent of maybe 25 to 30 black World War I veterans who've gone home, put on their uniforms to show their bona fides, come down to the courthouse and offer their assistance to help protect Dick Rowland, who at this point has been arrested and is in the jail at the top of the Tulsa County Courthouse. At this point, by 7 p.m., there's maybe 400 or so whites, mostly men, but there's some women and children also, at the courthouse. The sheriff assures the men there's going to be no lynching, encourages them to go back across the tracks into Greenwood, and tries to disperse the white crowd as well. There's some success with that, but by about 9, 9:30, the white crowd at the courthouse has gotten larger. People back in Greenwood are still very agitated. They make another trip down to the courthouse. And at this point, estimates are varying. There's maybe 50 to 75 black veterans. And again, the sheriff encourages them, go home. There isn't going to be a lynching.
So the authorities seem to be trying to quiet things down and disperse the black and white crowds that have gathered. So how did things reach the point of riot?
I think there was a failure of the Tulsa Police Department at this point. There's lots of talk right after the riot that 20 armed men could have easily dispersed the crowd, but they failed to do that. And in fact, that's one of the charges that Police Chief Gustafson is brought up on after the riot for having failed to disperse both the blacks and whites. Now, after this second confrontation, apparently some police officers are trying to disarm the black veterans who have shown up. One person we think is a police officer, it's a little bit unclear, is taking guns away, says to one of the leaders, "Where are you going with that gun?" And he says, "I'll use it if I have to." There's a struggle, the gun goes off, and then in the parlance of the time, all hell breaks loose.
One of the things that seems to have either turned this into a riot or made the riot even worse than it otherwise would have been is that a lot of the men who were initially part of the white mob ended up getting deputized as assistant police. Why were they deputized, and what did they do after being deputized?
You've put your finger on what strikes me as one of the key aspects of this riot. Right after the initial confrontation at the courthouse, when, in the words of the police chief and many other people at the time, all hell breaks loose, the response of the police department is to deputize dozens, perhaps hundreds, of men. There are allegations at the time that they're told to go home, get a gun, and get a black person, except they use much more offensive language than that, of course. Why exactly the police department did this is an important question. There's substantial evidence that they thought this was, to use the language of the time, a Negro uprising. Think about this, the way in which the black World War I veterans clashed with the ideas of the position they should occupy in Tulsa society. Those veterans, men who had traveled the world, came back with wonderful ideas about equality. And at the time, people in Greenwood are talking about the NAACP's anti-lynching campaign, the bill in Congress to prevent lynching. They're talking about the importance of arming themselves and protecting themselves against white attack. In September 1920, there was a lynching on the same weekend in both Tulsa and Oklahoma City. In Tulsa, it was a white man who was lynched. In Oklahoma City, it was a black man. And the Tulsa Star, the leading black newspaper at the time in Tulsa, editorialized, excoriated blacks in Oklahoma City for not having saved that man. They editorialized that it was their legal right, indeed their duty, to arm themselves, march to the jail, apprise the sheriff that they were there to protect life and that they should take life if need be to uphold the law and protect the prisoner. So at the time of the riot, the police think this is an uprising and want to do everything they can to put down the uprising. It's a climate of extraordinary fear that leads to this mass deputization.
Once the white men were deputized as assistant police, What did they do during the actual riot?
There's a lot of testimony that the people largely responsible for arresting blacks and then as soon as homes and businesses were vacant, burning them.
So it's people suddenly in this official capacity who are doing a lot of the damage. The National Guard was called in. How did the National Guard handle itself?
The National Guard is actually a very interesting story. Unlike the special deputies, who I think were largely responsible for the destruction, the National Guard, we need to break into two groups, the local units of the Guard and the units from Oklahoma City. The local units of the Guard were called into operation about 9:30 or 10 o'clock on the evening of May 31st. Their instructions from the governor are to not shoot unless fired upon and try and protect lives. Also, to arrest blacks and take them to the convention center. And by about 3 a.m. on the morning of June 1st, they're actively engaged in disarming and arresting blacks, turning them over to the civilian authorities, where they're taken to the convention center and detained. There is no evidence that either the local or the national or the out-of-town units of the Guard were involved in the burning. I think there's some culpability on the part of the local units of the Guard for simply arresting blacks and then leaving their property unprotected where it could be burned by the special deputies and the mob.
What was the motivation for arresting and detaining African Americans?
That's very interesting. There's some evidence that there was concern this was an uprising and they wanted to disarm and end the violence in that way. There's also some evidence that particularly the units of the National Guard from Oklahoma City were primarily concerned with trying to protect lives and in that way simply arrest and put into protective custody the Greenwood residents. Now, that strikes me as a very favorable interpretation for the Guard. There is a lot of evidence afterwards that the out-of-town units of the Guard were very important in protecting lives and that they treated Greenwood residents with respect. You can contrast, there are photographs of the riot, you can contrast. One is titled Captured Negroes on the Way to Convention Center, and they're walking with their hands up. That's a photograph of the special deputies taking Greenwood residents to the convention center. When you contrast that with National Guard troops, folks are not being marched with their hands up. It is a very different, I think, way of treating the people who are in custody.
My guest is Professor Alfred Brophy, author of the Tulsa Race Riot Commission Report. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Alfred Brophy is my guest. He's a professor of law at Oklahoma City University. He wrote the report Reconstructing the Dreamland, Contemplating Civil Rights Actions and Reparations for the Tulsa Race Riot of 1929. And the commission that he's part of is recommending reparations be paid to survivors of this 1921 race riot. And the report has been forwarded to the state legislature. After the riot was over, and after the African Americans who were kept at this detention center were released, were there any efforts at all made by the city or the state to help African Americans rebuild their homes, rebuild the neighborhood, rebuild the stores in the neighborhood?
There were some efforts, actually. The Private Reconstruction Committee in Tulsa collected, I think, about $100,000. There are wonderful stories about some of the local employers spending money to reconstruct houses for their employees who lived in Greenwood. I think that's one of the really important stories about the riot that people haven't focused on is the way in which churches as well as the Red Cross expended money and effort to try and reconstruct Greenwood.
But it obviously wasn't enough money to do a very effective job at reconstructing that neighborhood.
The property losses were estimated at $1.5 million, and as I say, I think it was about $100,000 that was expended of private money. It certainly was not the effort that one would have hoped Tulsa as an entire city would put forward. In fact, one of the interesting stories about the riot is just after the riot, the city council passes a zoning ordinance extending the fire limits to encompass Greenwood and prohibiting rebuilding of Greenwood with anything other than fireproof material. And that was made rebuilding prohibitively expensive. That was eventually struck down as an interference with property rights.
Was that seen as an intentional way of preventing African Americans from rebuilding?
It's very interesting, yes. At the time it was the zoning ordinance was passed, there was an article in the newspaper discussing the reasons for it. One was that they wanted to expand this would allow the expansion of the industrial district and the railroad yard that was there. And the second was to get more separation between the races. So essentially, the zoning ordinance was designed to prohibit rebuilding by blacks in Greenwood.
And these were the days when you could say that the intention is to separate the races, and that could be perceived as legit, a legit motive.
Absolutely. In fact, Tulsa still had a racially restrictive zoning ordinance, which the Supreme Court of the United States had struck down in 1917.
Well, let's look at the issue of reparations. That's why your commission was convened in the first place. And the commission has, in fact, recommended that reparations be given to the survivors of the 1921 Tulsa race riot, the survivors who had their homes destroyed or their businesses destroyed. Let's look at some of the key factors in deciding on reparations. You say that, one of the issues is that city officials failed to protect the lives of African-American residents. What are the specifics with that?
I think perhaps the strongest argument in favor of reparations is that the city had an affirmative hand in arresting blacks and burning Greenwood.
Through the deputizing of the white men.
Through the deputies, sure. And this is something that in the trial of the police chief afterwards for neglect of duty during the riot, the police commissioner acknowledges that we deputized people we shouldn't have deputized. There were people who may have lost their head after they got the badge. And this is the police chief who acknowledges this. And even the Oklahoma Supreme Court, not known for its enlightened attitudes towards race in the 1920s, acknowledges in an insurance case that many of the people doing the burning were wearing deputy police badges.
So the city not only didn't do enough to protect black residents, it took actions that helped destroy property and kill residents.
Absolutely. And I think that's what distinguishes and makes so the case for reparations in Greenwood so strong. This is not a case like Rosewood, where there was a terrible riot over the course of about a week in 1923 in Florida. The Florida legislature gave set aside about $2 million to help victims and their descendants of the Rosewood massacre. But in Rosewood, the state officials knew about the riot and didn't do anything to protect Rosewood residents. In Greenwood, I think the case is substantially stronger. Many of the people doing the burning were, at least temporarily, police officials. And then there's also on the part of at least the local units of the National Guard, they were arresting people, leaving their property defenseless, and that allowed then the mobs and the special deputies to come along and burn. Now, even if one were to say, well, these special deputies were acting sort of outside of the scope of their authority, there is still precedent for reparations when a local government fails to protect. Illinois, for instance, had a statute that provided for compensation when local officials didn't protect against a mob. So people whose property had been destroyed by mob in East St. Louis, and in Chicago in 1919 were able to recover.
What about the National Guard? Does the behavior of the National Guard that was called in during the riot enter into your recommendation that reparations be given?
I think the National Guard is going to be central. It strikes me as though there's lots of reason for giving reparations if all we have is the sort of misbehavior of local Tulsa officials. But in Oklahoma, there seems to be a sentiment growing that unless people can show that indeed the state, rather than the city of Tulsa, had some culpability, that the state legislature will not pay reparations.
And what do you think the culpability of the National Guard
is? I think the units of the National Guard that arrived from Oklahoma City at about 9 o'clock on June 1st did a great deal to actually save lives. There's lots of testimony from both blacks and whites that the Oklahoma City units of the National Guard ended the riot, that they, in fact, shot a number of white rioters. In fact, I have heard it said that one of the great secrets of the riot is the number of whites that were killed by the National Guard in putting down the riot. I think we're going to be focusing largely on the local units of the National Guard. Those local units came into operation at about 9:30 or 10 o'clock on the evening of May 31st, and from about 3 o'clock in the morning on June 1st on, they were systematically arresting blacks and turning them over, disarming them, arresting them, and turning them over to civilian authorities where they were detained at the convention center. Those arrests seem to have been based exclusively on race. There is testimony in one of the after-action reports of a local unit of the Guard that when they were fired upon, they'd arrested some blacks. They were taking them down to the convention center. And at that point, white rioters opened fire. And instead of going and trying to arrest the white rioters, the local unit of the Guard marches their prisoners at a faster pace. So I think there's a lot of evidence that suggests the local units of the Guard were working in close contact with the special deputies, the civilian authorities who we know were doing much of the burning.
Alfred Brophy wrote the Tulsa Race Riot Commission report recommending reparations. He'll be back in the second half of the show, along with a survivor of the riot. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From virtualrelocation.com, an online resource for moving and relocation, featuring cost of living comparisons and virtual city tours at virtualrelocation.com. And from Reel.com, an online source for movies, offering over 100,000 titles on VHS and DVD. On the web at reel.com, AOL keyword REEL. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, a survivor of the 1921 Tulsa Race Riot. Kenny Booker was 8 years old when white men came to his home, took his father away, and then burned the house down. And we continue our conversation with law professor Alfred Brophy, author of the new Tulsa Race Riot Commission report recommending reparations. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On today's program, we're talking about the Tulsa Race Riot of 1921, during which the African-American section of Tulsa, Oklahoma, was burned down by a white mob. About 8,000 people lived in the Greenwood neighborhood at the time. Around 60 to 70 people are still alive. The Oklahoma legislature recently appointed a commission to recommend whether reparations should be given. In a few minutes, we'll hear more from law professor Alfred Brophy, who wrote the commission's report recommending reparations for survivors. With me is one of the survivors, Kenny Booker. He was 8 years old at the time of the riot. His family's home was burned down by white men. Though as an adult, Booker moved from Oklahoma to California. He eventually returned to Tulsa. I spoke to him from his home there and asked him how he first realized there was a riot going on.
Well, I didn't know it was a riot, but we had been playing outside a little bit. My father said, go inside. I hear shooting and there's trouble brewing. He said, go upstairs and into the attic. We had an attic that was floored, and we'd go play up there sometimes. They had to ease access by having a good strong ladder. Okay, that's when we first heard about it. Didn't know it was a race riot at the time.
So then what happened?
Well, a few minutes, I don't know how long it was, much time intervened, but we went upstairs. We heard my father, who stayed downstairs, looking around, seeing what was happening. Someone came to the door, talking very loud and rough, asking him, nigger, do you have a gun? Father, soft-spoken ordinarily, but he said loud enough for us to hear, I don't have a gun. They said, well, let's go. They were rounding up people. We found out later, round up Negroes taken to shelters. Found out later. At that time, my father said loud enough for us to hear him, please do not set my house on fire, because back of us, we were near a town, the white section. Back of us, where they started burning, our houses were burning and everything, so he made this statement. At that time, we realized that he was warning us to get out of there if necessary.
Who were the white men who came to the door?
I didn't find out till later, but they were either citizens deputized by police department, some members of clans, I think, Ku Klux Klan, I think. I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
But they were white and have the Negroes going to town, going down to the white section. My father, I found out later, didn't know then, we went to one of the internment camp sites, convention hall center, okay?
What about you? What did you do?
We stayed up in the attic until father had spoken loud, and then we came down because we smelled smoke, and we realized then that they must have set a house on fire after he told them not to, because all the back of us was burning. So we got down and got out in a hurry.
Was it hard to get out of the house?
Not too hard because it wasn't a sudden explosive type of fire. It was going on slowly, so we were able to get out without hurting, because there were five of us up in the attic. Four siblings, myself and my mother.
Mm-hmm. What did you do when you got downstairs? Did you stay in the neighborhood or leave?
Well, to tell you, before we got out and heard, because we heard bullets raining on our rooftop. We thought it was airplanes, and it might have been from machine guns up on Sandpipe Hill, they called it. But anyhow, when we got down, they had men, white men, coming along, escorting Negro people, men, women, and children, to the convention center. So we were escorted along. And while we were going along, my poor sister, who was only five at the time, terrified, she said in a terrified, shaking voice, Kenny, is the world on fire? We were walking towards the white section, and there was no fire there because they were being protected by fire departments. If I could go there, definitely. Anyhow, I told her no, but we're in a heck of a lot of trouble, baby. So we went on to the convention center from there. Other people walked along, and bullets was whizzing, singing along in the air. Didn't hit anybody, but the telephone poles were behind us and getting closer, were falling, being burned down, and so forth. We were conducted to the convention center hall, okay? Hall center.
So what was it like in the convention center, which was being used as a detention center? Did you feel like you were put there to be punished, or that you were put there to be protected from the white mob?
Well, we were put there because they were rounding up the Negro men, trying to get any of them that had protective guns and so forth. But we were being protected in a way because they weren't shooting anything around in the convention center and the places where they carried the victim, the Negro victim. So we were not, whether we were protected or not, we had to be in a way because they were burning our homes down and killing ones that weren't in the center, but they weren't doing anything to the people in the center.
How long were you kept at the convention center?
This I can't remember. It's rather an anachronism for me to try to remember all that as I was 8 years old, and now I'm 80, almost 87, 86. But I can't give you an accurate time, but it was a few hours anyway.
Mm-hmm. And when they released you from the detention center, where did you go? Was your house burned to the ground?
Well, they weren't releasing any Negroes from the center unless some responsible, or they considered responsible, white person, especially those who were employees of the Negro men or women. My father worked for H.F. Wilcox. He was an oil tycoon, multimillionaire. And he asked for the book of family, and at that time we found out that my father was there, and he took all the whole family to his mansion, and we stayed there.
What kind of work did your father do for this millionaire?
He was a chauffeur and a handyman. He was given quite a bit of consideration because he could do things very well for this. Yeah.
How long did you live in the millionaire's mansion?
This I can't tell you either, but we lived there long enough for my sister Dorothy to play with his kids and things. I guess I can't tell you how long, but they had to clear all the debris from where the homes had burned down so they could put tents up. So I can't tell you how long, but we stayed there long enough for that to happen.
And then did you have to move into a tent?
We moved into a tent for a while, yes. We were fortunate enough for I had a 14-year-old brother, Doug, who, with my father's help, and finally we were able to get some lumber. I had a floor in our tent. We were lucky enough to have a floor because, if I remember correctly, it rained. Looked like that was an aftermath of the burning. It started raining. So we were lucky enough to have a floor in.
Was your house completely destroyed by the fire?
Oh, yes. Nothing but rubble.
Uh-huh. And after living in the tent for a while, when did you move into a house again?
Another time that I can't tell you how long it was, but we did finally get back into a house. The white people, I understand, my father was saying, they would not sell him lumber to have it start building back. They were trying to prevent the Negroes from building their homes back for a while until the city or someone who was responsible was sued by lawyers, and finally they were able to rebuild, but it took a while. You couldn't get materials for a while.
So your father had a house built for the family?
Oh, yes.
And was it in the same neighborhood?
Yes, it was, almost the same place. It was difficult. Surveyors had to come out, I imagine, to try to locate the places where you lived before, but it was practically the same place.
So what was left of the neighborhood? I mean, were there any stores left, any other homes left, or was everything built from scratch?
Everything that was, unless it's very far, far north, Negro stayed from separation of whites and blacks going north. Well, way in the back, there might have been some shacks left up, but all the homes were destroyed by fire, and most all of the businesses were destroyed. I think the high school, which was a Combination Elementary High School, Booker T. Washington, was not destroyed, whether by plans or not. But it was one of the places where Negroes were kept for shelter for the time being.
Had your family owned the house that was burned down?
Oh, yes. We had a nice three-bedroom home, car, piano. I learned how to play piano young. We had these things, yes.
Did you get any kind of compensation from the government or an insurance company?
Nothing. Insurance company, well, I don't know whether my father had insurance, but other people have said the insurance company would not honor the black homes that were insured. I don't know whether I was or not, but we didn't get any compensation for everything was lost. Could I make a statement about reparations?
Please.
Well, my idea is this. They claim they don't know whether the state or the local government were responsible, but now blacks and whites were paying taxes for protection like the police and fire department. The money was not black, it was green in color. But we were supposed to have protection. Instead of having protection for us, that money was being used for people who were destroying our homes. What an incredible thing that was happening. We were paying money at that time for protection, but the protection was for the people who were killing us and destroying our homes. That's what I wanted to say about reparations. Certainly that should be reparations. Financial. I don't mean a memorial. I don't want a memorial to remind me that some of my friends and all our homes were burned. I don't need that. I think financial reparations. Thank you for letting me say that.
Oh, sure. If the government does agree to give reparations to the survivors of the 1921 Tulsa riot, as one of the survivors, what would you hope to do with the money that you would get?
Well, be frank with you. Part of it, I would move, get away from this town as quick as I could. But I guess I'd have to divide with, you know, some of the survivors. I mean, some of my relatives. But I would use part of it to get away from Tulsa, that's for sure. The prejudice is still here. It's better. Things are better, but it's still here.
Do you ever run into white people of your age and wonder if they're the offspring of the people who burned down your house?
Oh, yes, I do. And most of them will say, well, I think I talked to one. They said, well, we weren't responsible, which is true. That didn't happen. But just like they inherit the good things that the family did, being helped by Negroes, they also inherit the bad things that did. They didn't do it, but the government did, and they should have reparations. We should.
Kenny Booker was 8 years old at the time of the Tulsa Race Riot. Coming up, more with the author of the Tulsa Race Riot Commission report recommending reparations for survivors. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our conversation with Alfred Brophy, the law professor who wrote the report for the Tulsa Race Riot Commission. The commission was created by the Oklahoma State Legislature. The report, which was given to the legislature earlier this month, describes what happened during the 1921 riot and recommends that reparations be given to the survivors. There are an estimated 60 to 70 people who would be eligible. A lot of your historical information comes from an interesting source. It was a lawsuit against an insurance company. The suit was filed by a man who is believed to be Native American, whose last name was Redfern. He lost a theater and a hotel in the riot, and his insurance company wouldn't compensate him for his losses, so he sued the company. Tell us a little bit more about this lawsuit and its relevance to the question of reparations.
Redfern was trying to recover on his insurance policy, and his insurance company said, as long as the property was burned during a riot, we're not liable because there's a riot exclusion clause. Redfern relied on some other state's precedent to show that if the police burned the property as part of putting down the riot exclusion clause wouldn't let the insurance company out from liability, that in fact it was if it's burned as part of official action, the right exclusion clause doesn't apply. He then wanted this as an opportunity to develop evidence that in fact the special police officers had done much of the burning. And his extensive testimony from Greenwood residents that the people who were doing the burning were wearing police badges. The Oklahoma Supreme Court ultimately construes the riot exclusion clause broadly and says, look, even if these special officers were doing the burning, that wasn't part of their official action. And therefore, it's sort of part of the general riot, and Redfern ends up not recovering. But it's
That's interesting, because even though he doesn't recover, basically the precedent is, the ruling is, that the deputies were responsible for a lot of what happened in the riot.
It's a wonderful opinion, and it's particularly important when you think this isn't some socialist Columbia history professor or W.E.B. Du Bois who's writing this. This is the Supreme Court in 1920. The Oklahoma Supreme Court in the 1920s, not known for its enlightened attitudes towards race.
Any other reasons why you're recommending that reparations be given to the survivors of the riot?
I think that there's sort of four reasons counseling in favor of reparations. First is the culpability of the city and, to a lesser extent, the state. The second is that there's still a living connection. The riot, I understand, was a long time ago. We are further from the riot today than the riot was from the days of Civil War. And yet there are still about 60 people who were victims of the riot and are still alive. I think that human connection is fundamentally important. There's another reason, though. We're asking for reparations not to correct some general societal discrimination. This was a very discrete harm concentrated in time and place. This isn't general societal discrimination. It is a very concrete harm. And the fourth reason I think is important is Tulsans at the time promised to make reparations. The chair of the Reconstruction Committee said Tulsa can only redeem herself from countrywide shame and humiliation by complete restitution and rehabilitation of the Black Belt. Tulsa weeps at this unspeakable crime and will make good the damage so far as can be done to the last penny.
A promise not kept.
Not at all.
So if the state legislature agrees with the commission report and decides to give reparations, what standards are you recommending be used to decide who gets the reparations and how much money those individuals get?
That'll be a very interesting question. Actually, what's in front of the legislature right now is a bill to extend the life of the commission. The first thing we need to, I think, focus on is completing the historical report. And then once the legislature decides either to extend the life of the commission or just to move immediately to its recommendations, at the point at which they're deciding on actual reparations, I think that we have a couple of models we can look to. I suggested we look to the Civil Rights Act of 1988, which gives compensation to Japanese Americans interned during World War II. And there, they required, in order for survivors to be able to recover, they required that you be alive at the time, that is in 1988. And then it was just a lump sum payment to each survivor. And I think that makes a lot of sense in this case. Rather than trying to go back and figure out value of property lost and things that at this point are very, very difficult to do, I think it would make sense to just sort of come up with a lump sum figure for each now living survivor. And this could be done actually relatively at a relatively modest cost. You figure there are approximately 60 survivors and give each of them $20,000, which is the precedent the Civil Rights Act of 1988 gave. That's less than $1.5 million. It's a very modest sum of money.
Why compensate survivors but not compensate the sons and daughters of survivors who might have inherited property but couldn't because it was destroyed?
That's an excellent question. Part of that, the answer, I think, turns on being able to prove with specificity damages. And also part of it turns on the idea that rather than going back and trying to write every wrong that the government has perpetrated. We want to focus on ones where we can identify some sort of still living human connection. I think something where we're giving compensation to people who are still alive will actually have a substantial amount of support.
My guest is Alfred Brophy, author of the Tulsa Race Riot Commission report, which recommends reparations for survivors of the 1921 riot. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Alfred Brophy. He's a professor of law at Oklahoma City University, and he wrote the report Reconstructing the Dreamland, Contemplating Civil Rights Actions and Reparations for the Tulsa Race Riot of 1921. This is a report that was commissioned by the state legislature in Oklahoma, and the commission is recommending that reparations be given to the black survivors of this race riot. There was a conference recently in Arkansas looking at a 1919 racial attack there in which about 200 African Americans were killed. Do you think that this is going to be happening all over now, that states will be looking at race riots of the past and trying to determine
what happened?
If there should be reparations? Yeah.
Absolutely. The Elaine, Arkansas 1919 riot was a terrible riot. And after that, there were about eight black men who were essentially railroaded into death sentences. And it actually became a very famous U.S. Supreme Court case. Justice Holmes talks about how people were swept away, judge, jury, prosecutor, public, swept away in a wave of public passion. That public passion swept across Tulsa in 1921, and a great many other small towns in Oklahoma, and other places throughout the United States. And I think this is an important, even if the Oklahoma legislature decides to never give reparations, we have succeeded a great deal in just bringing back into the public consciousness important pieces of our history.
Now, I know that some groups are concerned that if Oklahoma gives reparations to the race riot survivors, then every group that thinks it's been wronged will be asking for reparations. Are you concerned about that?
I'm not. I think there are some very important limiting principles related to the Tulsa riot that suggest there won't be claims to right every single wrong in the past, only ones that are truly egregious across a large spectrum and where we have some possibility of actually making things better.
Do you think that the Tulsa race riot in your commission's report comes into play at all in the question of should there be reparations for African Americans whose ancestors were enslaved in America?
I think that Tulsa could be the sort of the proving ground for legal and, more importantly, moral arguments about reparations in all sorts of contexts, in international contexts, in the context of slavery as well. I think we're going to hear a great deal more about the case for reparations for slavery in the next few years. Of course, under my sort of limiting principles, Tulsa wouldn't provide much of a precedent for reparations for slavery since, for example, there aren't any currently living survivors of American slavery.
Here's another question that I know some people are asking. Should people today have to pay for the sins of another generation?
That's a very interesting question. Lots of folks in Oklahoma say we shouldn't have to pay for something we are not responsible for. The interesting thing from my perspective is corporate entities have existences that are unrelated to the lives of any individual. Let me give you an example. Mobil Oil Company began polluting the water of Cyril, Oklahoma in the late 1940s. And as recently as the mid-1990s, they were responsible for paying for the cleanup of that water. It may very well be that the majority of Mobil shareholders weren't even alive in 1947 when the pollution began, and yet they still had to pay for it. When you think about Tulsa as an entity that had a life, the city of Tulsa has an entity that has a life before and after people who were there. The city itself should have to pay.
Well, Alfred Brophy, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been my pleasure.
Alfred Brophy is the author of the Tulsa Race Riot Commission report, recommending that reparations be given to the survivors of the 1921 riot, which destroyed the African-American neighborhood known as Greenwood. Brophy is a law professor at Oklahoma City University. The Oklahoma State Legislature has not yet voted on the issue of reparations. Fresh Air's senior producer today was Joan Tuohy Westman. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Monique Nazareth, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet, with Anne-Marie Baldonado and Patty Leswing. Research assistance from Brendan Noonan. I'm Terry Gross. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Garden.com, an online source for gardening advice and home delivery of over 14,000 plants, tools, and gardening products. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, using DNA testing to help release the wrongly convicted, we talk with lawyers Barry Scheck and Peter Neufeld, co-founders of the Innocence Project. Scheck is best known for his DNA analysis on the O.J. Simpson defense team. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.